I'm Louise Steinman, curator of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented free by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. You're about to hear Susan Jacoby, author of The Age of American Unreason, in conversation with Jack Miles. From the author of Freethinkers, a dazzlingly insightful and occasionally hilarious analysis of the anti-rationalism, anti-intellectualism, and anti-scientism that increasingly characterizes the cultural and intellectual life of this country. This program was originally produced on February 26, 2008. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
As a fundamentalist religion, that's a component part, but it's far from the only one. You can talk about television. You can talk about youth culture, celebrity culture. You can talk about the 60s. Did it all somehow come unstuck in the 60s? Or you can talk instead about what made it good when it was good. And this, to me, is really perhaps the most fascinating and elusive part of the story. Before asking Susan to talk to us a little bit about that, I want to recall a story that I recently heard told about a conversation that took place between George W. Bush and the then Prime Minister of Spain, José María Aznar. Aznar was conservative. If you recall from the earlier stages of the war in Iraq, he sent troops to Iraq and wanted very much to be a backer of the American president in his undertaking. But he thought it essential that that the American president be candid with the public of the world about the difficulty of the task that lay ahead. And he said, after all, there are Sunni as well as Shia in Iraq, to which Bush replied, oh, I thought they were all Muslims. Now, this isn't sinister. This isn't some kind of religious plot. This is what we call conventionally a dumb mistake. But at the time that the surge was announced a year ago last January, its stated goal was to bring about reconciliation in Iraq. Reconciliation. Between whom and whom? Reconciliation between the Sunni and the Shia. A strange turn of events when the United States of America finds itself going to war to bring about reconciliation between two religious groups in a foreign country. The epigraph to Susan's book reads, from if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. Thomas Jefferson. A nation achieves its greatness from the bottom up, or if there is greatness at the top, there's greatness at the middle, and there's a certain kind of greatness at the bottom as well. Eric Hoffer, the longshoreman philosopher, said, America may not have the greatest culture in the world, but it does have the greatest mass culture. And there's a chapter in this book that's really quite fascinating to me, being a product of the culture that it describes, called Middlebrow Culture, From Noon to Twilight. Why don't you tell us what you mean by middlebrow culture, Susan, and why you think it important to talk about middlebrow culture in a book on the age of American unreason?
Well, it's a phrase that has, of course, gone very much out of fashion. Middlebrow culture was really in its heyday in the 40s and 50s, I would say. But it really began actually much, much longer ago with what was called the 19th century Lyceum movement, which was really a series of public lectures on a lot of topics, originally aimed at working people who didn't have the opportunity to go to high school, which was very rare at the time. Sort of the high point of middlebrow culture, which I say was in the 40s and 50s, it was a reading culture. It was the culture of the Book of the Month Club. It was the culture of every family having an encyclopedia in their home. It was a culture, by the way, which was much mocked by highbrow intellectuals, because part of the key to millbrow culture, the idea of the Book of the Month Club and the great book series sponsored by the University of Chicago, was you would through going to people who were more educated than you were, they would tell you what was good to read. They would help you select what was good to read. Now, this is an idea that sounds ludicrous today, because the very idea of going to other people to select things for you is very antithetical to today's culture. And if I look back on this culture with regret rather than with contempt, it's that I think the highbrows had it all wrong. Middlebrow culture really wasn't an end in itself. What it was for many people was a portal to something better. And it was something that encompassed all kinds of people. It encompassed immigrants. It encompassed African Americans. I was very moved when I read John Hope Franklin, the great African American historian's book, Mirror to Hope. And he described, you know, growing up in segregated Oklahoma, about going in the segregated balcony to hear a visiting performance of La Traviata from the Chicago Lyric Opera Company. And his parents objected to this because they didn't think that you should participate in any public event that involved segregation. But he did, because he wanted to hear the opera so much. Well, broadcasts from the Metropolitan Opera were part of middlebrow culture, even though he was very young still, even in the dawn of radio, actually. And he went, and these things were all part of middlebrow culture. Now, would you like me to read a very short excerpt or not? I really never know whether people want to hear
it. Chorus of yeses.
And okay, this will be short, though. To be raised in a middlebrow family in the 1950s meant that there were books, magazines, and newspapers in the house, and that everyone old enough to read had a library card. If much of the reading material was scorned by highbrow intellectuals, the books certainly provided ample food for growth. It simply staggers me to recall a variety of popular contemporary or near-contemporary novels, some of which came to us through the Book of the Month Club, but primarily from the public library, scattered throughout the house during my childhood. A potpourri of favorite fiction read to tatters by age 15 would have included James Michener's Sayonara and Tales of the South Pacific and Hawaii, Howard Fast's Spartacus, Lloyd C. Douglas's The Robe. As long as the book had something to do with ancient Rome, I didn't care much whether it was written from the perspective of a Christian, an atheist, or a lion. Irving Stone's The Agony and the Ecstasy, James Jones's From Here to Eternity, Neville Shoots on the Beach, Herman Woke's Marjorie Morningstar, and a harbinger of things to come at the end of the decade, Philip Roth's Goodbye Columbus. One of Roth's short stories, Defender of the Faith, was printed in 1959 in The New Yorker, a magazine that bridged the gap between middlebrow and highbrow, and was revered in our home in Okemos, Michigan, as a weekly emissary from the capital of sophistication and excitement. My hodgepodge of contemporary fiction was only dessert reading, on top of the classics, the meat and potatoes my parents never pushed but somehow assumed I was ingesting. And they were right. I'd read a good deal of Shakespeare, Twain, and Dickens, my favorite old novelist as I thought of him, as well as a fair amount of first-rate 18th and 19th century poetry by the time I entered high school. In addition to reading and displaying reproductions of works by dead painters, of which Virginia Woolf spoke of so contemptuously, middlebrow parents promoted an interest in history and current affairs. When you took summer vacations, they usually included places of historic significance. Lexington and Concord, Gettysburg, Hyde Park, Appomattox. Yes, the Book of the Month Club News had alerted us to Bruce Caton's A Stillness at Appomattox. As soon as Edward R. Murrow's I Can Hear It Now broadcasts were released on the then very new long-playing RPM records, my parents brought them so that we could hear the famous speeches of Winston Churchill, Franklin Roosevelt, and Adolf Hitler, as well as Murrow's broadcasts from London during the Second World War. There were, of course, many individual and ethnic and regional variations in middlebrow culture. My father had no use for the weighty outlines of history and philosophy, such as Will Durant's The Story of civilization, which were much mocked by intellectuals as at the time. His view, and it probably would have surprised him that he had known it was shared by people he called eggheads, was that the story of civilization was already available on library shelves in books by novelists and poets whose words were open without the necessity of writing a check to some commercial entity to anyone who cared to read them. Now, I make no mistake about the greatness of the Middle Brow mosaic of my childhood. The certification of pieces of cultural experience is great. In order to market them to middle and lower class Americans in search of guidance was a justifiable sort of amusement, a justifiable source of amusement. And not only as my father's distrust of cultural arbiters indicated on the part of highbrow intellectuals. In our current infotainment culture, in which every consumer's opinion is supposed to be as good as any critic's, it is absurd to imagine that a large commercial entity would attempt to use any objective concept of greatness as a selling point for anything. Now, that people should aspire to read and think about great books, or even aspire to being thought of as the sort of person who reads great books, is not such a bad thing for society.
Well, one of the charms and real merits of the Age of Unreason is the way that Susan mingles completely relevant first-person information of this sort with a lot of factual information, a lot of research on the state of the American mind. So where did all that go? Is it all gone?
It's not all gone, but actually I think a lot of the remnants of this earnest middle brow striving, I think that where they survive is in a lot of immigrant cultures. There's a reason why in New York City they publish the list of high school valedictorians every year. And every year I am not surprised, but in a way it's an appalling commentary on our educational system to read that immigrants make up about 90% of the valedictorians, and not immigrants who came here 18 years ago, but people who maybe came here after having had part of their education in Russia or in Haiti, and who somehow after 4 years of American school were already so far ahead of American kids that they became valedictorians even though they arrived with low English skills. But I think one reason this concept went away really simply is our shortened attention span. This was the heyday of print culture. We did not have access to infotainment 24 hours a day. We couldn't carry our iPods with us. We didn't have 24-hour television. Some of you who are old enough will remember the American flag that used to come on the TV at midnight, and that was it. After 12 o'clock, you got no more television. There were no DVDs and VCRs, so you had to do something else, whether it was just getting into trouble or then usually going to bed and reading a book. So I think that the ubiquitousness of 24-hour mass media certainly has had something to do with the decline of middle-brow culture. Now, a lot of people also say we have less time, and they say that computers are the middle, you know, what's on the internet is the middle-brow culture of today. I don't think that's true. My book has already been much criticized as being an anti-technology book, which isn't the case at all. But I think that the way we're thinking about technology is wrong. I think the idea that the internet is a revolution in knowledge, that it's almost something that's the equivalent of God, I think that's quite wrong. The internet, all of the digital media, all of the new ways in which we can get information, they're just tools. And I think when we start thinking of them as something other than tools, we're making a big mistake. For example, a man named Stephen Johnson, who is the author of an emerging technology column for Discover magazine, wrote that all of the studies about the decline of reading, such as the ones recently released by the National Endowment for the Arts, are flawed because they ignore the explosion of reading that's occurred on the internet. My answer to that is the explosion of reading that's occurred on the internet is not reading as it's traditionally been known. When I read on the internet, basically I'm not reading as in the way I read, whether it's a literary book or whether it's a mystery novel or whether it's a nonfiction book. I'm trolling for chunks of information. I'm looking for a date or something I don't remember to insert into one of my articles. It's not reading. In fact, the very reason I use the internet is as a shortcut, and there's nothing wrong with that. But when you get in the habit of confusing, trolling for these chunks of information with real reading, then what you're talking about are facts unrelated to any larger body of knowledge.
It's like the difference between reading a book and consulting a book, isn't it?
Right, of course, exactly.
I recall hearing Bill Gates say, or reading, that Bill Gates had said that if he had something 10 pages long or longer to read, he wouldn't read it from the screen. He would always download it. And we're talking, you know, I think about the loss of the capacity to follow accounts that that might take 100 pages, 200 pages to make. And if you try to do them in fewer pages than that, you may not actually get the story. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, part of it, but I think one of the things, you know, if we're going to relate this a bit to the political culture, is this: when you have print accounts, I mean, even if you're talking about relatively short newspaper accounts, one of the things you tend to do is compare accounts. And this is easier to do in print, as I think this is a point Caleb Crane made in an excellent article in New Yorker before around Christmas time. It is easier to compare the facts and the analysis in two print things than it is to compare anything on video. Because what? And in fact, people don't watch nearly as much television news as they used to either. But if something seems a bit wrong to you on television, you don't have time because it's gone. You know, it may be in a vault of images, but it's not available for you. And I think the problem with the internet, newspapers, for instance, as you know, 10 years ago, newspapers thought that online editions would save them. They thought that young people who have stopped reading newspapers in droves would read online just because it was online. And this, again, is the confusion between the use of a tool and a different kind of knowledge. But in fact, young people don't make up any larger proportion of the online reading public for newspapers than they do of traditional print. But what we do know now about online editions of newspapers, and it's pretty ominous, is that everybody who reads newspapers online tends to read less more quickly. In other words, they're also reading newspapers in more of a trolling chunks for information way. Well, again, this is great if you're aware that you're doing it as a shortcut. It's not great if what you're doing is just clicking on for 30 seconds and thinking that you've got the whole story.
As somebody who's written commentary in both print and online, I know that I've been advised by my online editors at places like Slate that the limit online is 700 words.
Yeah.
Now, you can easily get 800 in a Los Angeles Times, New York Times op-ed, and if it's a Sunday piece, you can get 1,200, even 1,500 once in a while. But 700 seems to be the limit. And at that, we're talking about a piece of connected prose, when what people more often are reading are blogs, trading things, kicking them back and forth. It certainly is difficult, isn't it, to compare what Clinton's position or Obama's position is on healthcare or immigration from the debate. You can't remember it 5 minutes later, and neither can the professionals who are there delivering that. So that's what we're... That's what we're reduced to, you're saying. We don't have the control of information that we used to have.
Right. And, well, look, you know, you mentioned Clinton and Obama's positions. There's been a lot of discussion about health care, and General Hillary Clinton, for instance, you know, generally acknowledging, as is generally acknowledged, that the Clinton effort at health care reform was a failure. Well, one of the reasons it was a failure was the Harry and Louise commercials. I'll bet you everybody in this room who's old enough to remember the Clinton health care reforms remembers the Harry and Louise commercials, which were basically aimed at scaring people who had insurance into thinking they would lose it. And hardly anyone, I guarantee you, none of us remember what the details of the Clinton health care reform plan were. And that's really exactly what's wrong. I did do a piece of, you know, mentioning this in the Los Angeles Times the week before last. And one of the things is, it's part of the larger problem, not just reading, but also presidents used to feel a necessity to educate people in advance about things. But I think that the decide first, explain later school of decision making, which a lot of people mistakenly think is just an invention of George W. Bush. I think the Clinton health care reform plan was a good example of that too. He announced it to Congress. That was it. Nobody was prepared for any of the details, as say Franklin Roosevelt prepared a very reluctant public to think about the stake of America in the future of Europe in the late 1930s. And this is all related to the way we learn.
Tell about what you have in the book about Roosevelt and the maps in the Pacific.
This was actually at the height of the Battle of Britain when Roosevelt was trying to get a then-reluctant Congress to pass lend-lease aid to Britain. The American public in 1940, which is after the invasion of Poland, the Nazi invasion, and while England is in mortal danger, is still completely opposed to any direct American... the map thing came
Pacific,
later.
Pacific.
Right, the map thing actually came a month after Pearl Harbor, when people were still reeling from the shock. And Roosevelt wanted to explain to people why America was losing in the Pacific at that time, you know, the geography of battle. So he asked Americans to go out and buy maps. And maps sold out all over the country. And that was a 45-minute fireside chat, one of his longest. And he sat down and he explained, he showed people to follow why he was trying to explain why it was necessary to start to fight in Europe before America would have geographically be able to move the resources to the Pacific to fight. And one reason I also mentioned the Lend-Lease thing is he didn't ask people to buy maps that time, but what he did in the Lend-Lease speech in 1940 was try to explain to them what would happen to America if Japan controlled the shipping lanes in the Far East and the Nazis controlled them in Europe. Right. Now, a president could do this today. We have Google Maps, but they don't, because no president expects that 75% of the American people will sit down for 45 minutes and listen to him.
Well, do you think there's a chance, though? I mean, if a president were so foolhardy as to try it, do you think there's an audience in this room that would respond? This isn't a university audience. This is general Los Angeles thoughtful public audience.
Actually, I do think that there is a chance that if a president wanted to launch this kind of an educational program, that there might be a much bigger response than anyone anticipates. First of all, it would be a novelty. It would be something that people aren't used to. It would be a novelty, for instance, if a president in his first address to the American people after he or she was elected president would say, now, one of our major issues is health care. Let's just take health care. And we haven't had enough discussion about this. And I'm going to tell you what I think some of our needs are. One of the things such a president might theoretically do, for instance, is tell people, now you've been told that we have the greatest health care system in the world and that everybody in Europe hates their health care system. But let me tell you what they do in France and Norway and what happens to people who don't have money for health insurance here. And I can also see, obviously, a president can't do it in the same way that Roosevelt did it. I said this in the Los Angeles Times. Why not have an online chat led by the president instead of by Harry and Louise?
Right. Remember Ross Perot with his little charts? they actually worked, didn't they? I mean, people didn't object to that. It was surprising how much mileage he got out of those simple little cards.
But he wasn't the president either. A president, at least at the beginning of his administration, has a lot more leeway than someone who is just a presidential candidate as well.
Before we turn to questions from the audience, and Susan and I agreed we wanted to do that sooner rather than later tonight, I would like to ask Susan to comment on what has gone wrong, if something has gone wrong with American higher education, and when it went wrong, and maybe say a little bit about your experience in the 60s, since some people say it all went haywire then, and others look back to the 60s as the post-Sputnik era, the high point of of American young people's enthusiasm and ambition for intellectual attainment.
And I belong in both categories, I should say, in both categories. First of all, I mean, yes, I have a chapter titled Blaming It on the 60s. And I make the point, part of the right-wing script about what has gone wrong intellectually in America is it's all because of the 60s. It's all because these crazy anti-war protesters and black power people and pot smokers and feminists just destroyed the university core curriculum and
the Alan Bloom thesis.
Right, and everything went up in smoke. And a lot of left-wing people my age do look back and romanticize this period as the greatest period of their lives and don't think much about the difference maybe between the education they had. A lot of the anger of radical students in the 60s at universities was simply that universities were involved in defense-related war research, but it spilled over onto everything. The point I make in my book about higher education, and I think that we're suffering from the legacy of that today, and not just the legacy, but the institutionalization. What happened in the early 1970s was this, and it was really a shameful bargain made by both the right and the left, which is what people like Alan Bloom will never admit, is that the right had its part in it. Instead of adding African American studies and women's studies and literature by women and literature by African Americans, as well as many aspects of the study of other cultures to the core curriculum, which is what I think should have been done. I mentioned in this book that when I graduated from Michigan State University in 1965 without ever having read a single word written by a black American, I think that was the common experience of all students who went to universities then. But instead of saying our core curriculum needs to be expanded to include these things, the settlement that was reached in the 1970s was this: women's studies, African American studies, and various kinds later on of multicultural studies were shunted off into what I call a multicultural academic ghetto. Of course, it's not multicultural at all. Instead of saying that African-American history is American history and that the core curriculum in American history for all students need to be expanded, what they did was they shunted it off. There are a few very good universities in which this is not the case, in which white students take African-American studies courses. But it is still, at most universities, it's quite possible not to have any exposure to what are called multicultural studies. And it's quite possible for, say, someone who majors in women's studies or African American studies not to get exposed to what was then called the core curriculum, which is white Western civilization. Now, what the left wing got out of this was jobs. It created a lot more jobs if you create new departments. What the right wing got out of it is they were able to go on teaching their courses in exactly the same old way. Alan Bloom didn't have to add anybody to Plato. He didn't have to listen to all of those women questioning whether Plato was really right about certain things. And so what this did, in a way, is it was a very big missed opportunity not to ghettoize, but to expand it. And I think universities today are suffering from this legacy. I recently on a radio forum, on an NPR forum, there was a professor at Berkeley who said that one of the reasons my book was being so well received, he implied, is that books like this, which hark back to a golden age that never was, are always popular at times when people fear change. This was the classic multicultural line. And I said to him, you know, obviously you haven't read my book if you think that I think that the 50s and the 60s were some kind of a golden age. What I said was the mistake was made was just what I said here. But this idea that people who say that there is something wrong with the general state of our knowledge and our culture, something wrong today, that there are people who just want to go back to the old DWEM curriculum, as it were, this is just wrong. But it's something, so I think that both the left and the right at the university level have a lot to answer for about this then and now.
Thank you. That gives us at least a set of topics of why we have come to this condition, where we were, where we might be going. And I welcome now comments, questions from the floor, and there is a wandering microphone. So here's the first question in the front row.
Simple question.
Not on.
We'll repeat the question. Go ahead.
Okay. The changes in communications, internet 24/7, 500 channels, it's not just in the U.S., yet some of the problems are only in the U.S. Why?
The multiplication of communication outlets, drowning everybody out, is not just an American problem, but it seems that this decline of standards is only an American problem, right?
I don't know if it's only an American problem, but obviously people all over the world are subject to the same influences, a lot of them made in America, by the way, that we are subject to in terms of the infotainment culture. I think one of the reasons it's had worse effects in America than, let's say, the developed countries of Europe is this, that we have an educational system which is much weaker in many ways than that of the other developed countries in the world. First of all, because we have no national curriculum standards. There are great differences, for instance, in social values in, let's say, southern Italy and northern Italy. But if you go to high school, whether you go to high school in Agrigento or in Milan, if you go to high school, you're taught the same things about science and Italian history because that's the way the school system works. Here in America, and this would be one of the most difficult things to solve, we have a strong tradition of local control of schools, which again played an important role, as Richard Hofstadter said, in the democratization of education. But what it has also done is ensure that schools in rich neighborhoods will be better than schools in poor neighborhoods. It ensures that schools in less educated areas will be worse than schools in more educated areas. It ensures that in states and localities where, let us say, right-wing religious fundamentalism is most strong, that teachers will be afraid to use the word evolution in classroom, whereas if you're in Italy, you have to use the word evolution whether you like it or not, because that's mandated from the ministry in Rome. So that aspect of American education is pretty bad. And we are in a richer country. We actually have more TVs, and one thing that's particularly different is we are the leader in the world in extending the use of video to younger and younger ages. Even while I was writing this book, I was hardly able to keep up with the explosion of the videos for babies and TV for infants industry. Baby First TV only started a year and a half ago, and it is providing programming for children as young as 6 months. And the idea is to have a video screen literally in the cradle. And indeed,
welcome early, I guess.
Well, more than half of children under six do have TVs in their bedrooms. So certainly the extension of these things lower and lower. What it does is it wires, I think young brains to start focusing on prepackaged stimuli with a lot of noise right from the beginning. And one of the worst studies I saw was from the University of Washington, that among children under six, the average child watches video 2 hours a day but is only read to by parents about 38 minutes a day. And that is pretty awful, because there's a very early kind of learning that takes place. And I think the fact, in a way, that we are the leader in that kind of technology and are pushing it on younger and younger kids also makes us, look, we may be only ahead of the curve. Maybe the rest of the world will get as badly off as we are. But right now, that's not the case. And it's why, for example, in terms of math and science and knowledge of their own country's history, we rank, in math, we rank the lowest among 24 developed countries. In science, we rank in the middle. And in knowledge of our own history, forget about world history, we also rank very poorly.
Right here.
I'll try to make shorter answers, by the way. I'm sorry.
Thank you. one comment and then a more substantive question. I went to UCLA in the 1980s, undergraduate and then graduate. I was teaching assistant when I was in graduate school for two different professors teaching Western Civ. And I certainly saw a generational difference between one older professor who taught dead white men's history and grudgingly included some other aspects of it, and a younger professor who included what you might call a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-gender approach to their instruction of the basic history. So I don't, from at least one experience, I don't know if by the 1980s it had really penetrated that far based on what you were saying in terms of the compromise in the 70s. I guess the question I have, I didn't get from your conversation so much what the substantive premise of your book is, though. What are the reasons for dumbing down American culture? And I guess my guess from what you're saying is that it has to do with the essentially what the values are in the United States, that we've given up the value of being intellectually curious and making the effort to learn things, investigate things. And so I guess I'm asking two questions. One is, what's the premise of the book? And second, what do you think about this idea of the change in what American values are?
I jumped ahead a bit and started asking Susan about the reasons, you know, and the origins. But the book begins with quite a bit of delivery of evidence of ignorance and evidence of declining consumption of serious cultural products.
Well, actually, the basic premise of my book is that all of these reasons we talked about have led to a vast diminution of intellectual curiosity. And I will give you really a great example of this. Lack of knowledge can be corrected. In 2006, National Geographic, lack of knowledge can always be corrected. It can be corrected for people who start out with no knowledge. It can even be corrected later on in life. I'm a good example of that. I deliberately skipped over science because Michigan State allowed you to do it if you got good grades. I found out soon when I got out into the world of journalism that the fact that I didn't know anything about science was really debilitating. And I learned and I took some more classes. So lack of knowledge can be corrected. This 2006 National Geographic Roper poll showed that, and this is bad. It showed that of students who have some college, fewer than one out of four could identify Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Israel on a map, which are obviously four countries of great importance to the United States. And this wasn't a blank map of the world. It was a map with the names of the countries written in. I want to make that clear, because what it meant was they didn't even know what part of the world to look for these countries in. And of the 20, even fewer high school graduates, half of those could identify it. So this is ignorance. You know, college tuition, your kids can't even identify these countries on a map. But then they ask questions. This was a poll of people between 18 and 25. They ask, do you think it's important to know the location of countries in which important news is being made? And half of them said no. And see, this is not just lack of knowledge. This is contempt for knowledge. You know, you might as well have ignorant and proud of it stamped on your forehead. A similarly large number of people said that they didn't think it at all important to know a foreign language. And this is one of the reasons that I say that George Bush is a symptom rather than, I hate it when people ask me, don't I think the Bush administration is responsible for the dumbing down of America? I think the Bush administration is a symptom of the dumbing down of America. And look, there is this equally famous as the story you told at the beginning is when Bush was having a joint press conference with Jacques Chirac in Paris in 2002. David Gregory started to speak, ask Chirac a question in French, and Bush just got enraged. And he said, the guy knows four words, and he plays like he's intercontinental. This is a president showing obvious contempt for anybody who speaks to a president of another country in a foreign language. But he is the product of a public that doesn't think it's important either. Europeans would be ashamed to have a president if a French president made fun of a French correspondent for asking a question in English, the French would think it was ludicrous.
Over here.
So you're speaking about the dumbing down of America, about the MTV generation, about the ADD, which has become a very current phrase that many people know about, not having attention. And I'm wondering, is it possible that there's a new kind of intelligence being developed, which we haven't identified yet, which has to do, seriously, which has, if you look at our children, it has to do with computers, with eye-hand coordination, with being prepared for a different kind of society than we have ever known before, and that they haven't lost intelligence, but they're being groomed in a way that we don't even understand quite yet of what the future will be like in terms of robots, in terms of all kinds of technological wizardry that we're just starting to hear about. So what I'm really saying is, let's say that it's not intelligence that's being lost, but that there's a mutation going on in the way people are going to behave, and our children are getting prepared for it.
I think most people heard this question. First of all, I don't really have anything to say about intelligence. I'm talking about intellect and knowledge. That's different from intelligence. I don't think today's children are any less intelligent than we are, any more than I think that my grandmother was dumber than I am because she didn't know some of the things graduating from eighth grade in 1913 that I know today. So intelligence is not the subject at all. My subject is memory and knowledge and intellectual curiosity. And what I really object to, and I hear it all of the time from people, is how much smarter our kids are than we are because they know how to use computers better than we do. This is just ridiculous. Computers, of course, kids know how to use computers better than we do, and people who are 30 generally know how to use computers better than people who are 50. People who are 50 generally know how to use them better than people who are 70. But this is not a new kind of intelligence. It's being great at taking shortcuts. What are most of those kids doing on YouTube? They are not, again, reading. If you want to say that reading and general knowledge aren't important, and that the ability to use computers and maybe find a piece of information faster than I can find it, a lot of kids can do that. And more important, they can fix my computer when it goes down, which I can't do. But that doesn't have anything to do with my subjects, which are knowledge and values and intellectual curiosity. I would love to be able to fix a computer. I would also love to be able to fix a car, which I also can't do. These things have absolutely nothing to do with intelligence at all. They have to do, and it's good for kids to be skilled at using computers, just like it would be good if I knew how to fix a car. But it doesn't have anything to do with knowledge and values and intellectual curiosity and what is generally required for being an informed citizen and appreciation of beauty and all of the things that, in my view, go into culture, of which computers will be one.
I spent a year as a guest professor at Caltech, and all the students I taught there, because I was recently in the employ of the Los Angeles Times, I was curious, you know, to find out if these most gifted students in America, I thought, ever read the newspaper. The answer was never. With one exception, there was one student who did, and he was quite distressed at the fact that his classmates, some of whom he freely admitted were more brilliant than he, though I found him as brilliant as they, were ignorant. They were very intelligent. They were highly skilled in manipulating the technology that they employed in conducting their research. But it was so all-absorbing, the pressure on them was so extreme, that they blocked out the world in which they were going to be deploying all this skill, all this technology. He found that alarming, and I know some of the senior professors, Kip Thorne, some of the most gifted people there were concerned about this as well.
More questions?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Again, first a comment, then a question. The comment is perhaps you haven't given enough credit to Oprah with regard to replacing the Book of the Month Club. I think her her effort in that regard's fairly substantial. The question is, what hope do you see for a country like this where someone can run for president, several people who believe the world was created literally 6,000 years ago and dinosaurs and human beings roamed the earth together, and the people, the candidates who perhaps do speak another language, like Kerry, who speaks fluent French, or Obama, who speaks Indonesian but dare not admit it. What hope is there for us?
What hope is there for us? I wish you hadn't asked that question. But first of all, I would like to mention, and by the way, I'm not one of those people who denigrates Oprah and her books. That's fine. But in fact, Oprah has not replaced the Book of the Month Club, because what the Book of the Month Club used to do is it offered you a vast array of choices and selections. What Oprah does is descends like an angel on a book. I don't know whether it's once a month or once every 2 months now, but she descends like an angel on one book. Unlike the Book of the Month Club, Oprah does not offer extensive, if you ever got the Book of the Month Club news in the 1950s, you know, it offered extensive reviews, sometimes of books which were not very popular at all, like Catch 22, for example, which was a commercial flop, but which the Book of the Month Club news alerted millions of people to things that they wouldn't have known about. Oprah alerts millions of people to the one book that she descends on every month. That's a very different thing. But what hope do I see for a culture in which three guys in business suits can raise their hands and say they don't believe in evolution and be considered serious candidates? These guys also probably believe that Tinkerbell doesn't die in Peter Pan because the audiences clap their hands. Well... Of course, candidates like that would be laughed off the stage in most developed countries of the world. However,
I think in this one too, actually.
However,
Tinkerbell. The Tinkerbell was what I was.
There is one hope, and I think the fact is that a third of Americans are fundamentalists. And by fundamentalists, I mean literally believe in a literal interpretation of sacred books. And Mike Huckabee is a fundamentalist also. In other words, if you believe that a book that says the earth was created in 6 days is literally true, then obviously you can't accept evolution and you can't reconcile many aspects of modern knowledge and religion. However, there's something that's been forgotten, which is that two-thirds of Americans don't believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible. Americans may be more religious than people in the developed world, but plenty of Americans subscribe to a form of religion. You may not. I'm an atheist, so I, in fact, don't find religion in general, for me, intellectually compatible with modern science. But I recognize that the human brain is wired to accept all kinds of incompatible ideas. And two-thirds of our people are both religious in their own fashion, and they accept modern science and don't believe that, for instance, the Bible is based on divine inspiration, but not that it's literally true. And I think one of the things that has to be done is thoroughgoing secularists and people of moderate, intelligent religion have to get together on the issues in which they agree. And I'm not sure that's impossible. I'm very ambivalent about it, but I'm not one of these people. I don't agree with my friend Sam Harris that moderate religion is the great enemy of intellect as fundamentalism, because it's the stalking horse for fundamentalism. I think that we have to be realistic and realize that there are a lot of issues on which secularists, who, by the way, as a recent thing by the poll by the Pew Forum shows, have doubled their numbers in the last few years. I don't think it's as hopeless as the fact that we have a third of our people believing in a literal interpretation of the Bible would suggest.
I'd like to offer one little glimmer of hope before we finish.
Yeah, let's have a few glimmers. Yeah.
The French philosopher Jacques Maritain, in his book Reflections on America, said that what struck him about the culture of this country was how intensely in touch with each other Americans seemed to be, and how suddenly large changes could come about. So if it should happen that a concern of the sort that Susan expresses in this book should take hold in our country with some backing from influential Americans, we could be surprised by how quickly the climate could change, and in particular with regard to that attitude you were talking about, Susan, where I don't know and I don't care, and in fact I'm an underachiever and proud of it. The proud of it could start to drop away. That attitude could change.
Yeah, there's a lot. You know, there's a lot to be said for being ashamed of what you don't know.
Exactly.
There really is. I think, you know, a little bit of shame. You know, the public stocks, not such a bad idea.
Right here, you've been waiting for a while.
Apropos to your last comment, do you think that there is a duty on the part of the president or the government to essentially call us out, whether you're a fundamentalist or you're one of those college students with a map of the Middle East and can't find Israel?
Yes, and I'll tell you something. Actually, Bill Moyers asked me this, and he's right. Obviously, I mean, ignorance is a word you never hear. And obviously, the way to win an election is not to go out and tell an audience full of people, you're stupid, you're ignorant, get with it. This is not a winning political message. However, canny politicians, there is something you can say, which is, all of us, and any candidate would be justified in saying that about himself or herself too, that all of us have been lazy and deficient in learning what we need to know to make informed public decisions, and we have to change this climate. That is a very different thing than laying the blame on everybody else, because politicians are just members of the public. That's all they are. And I was, in fact, very encouraged. After the Wisconsin primary, Barack Obama was making his victory speech, and he said something about education. And he said, you know, the solutions to this are not going to be easy, and one of them is going to have to be better parenting. We're all going to have to show more willingness to turn off the TV, to put away the video games, to spend more time talking and reading to children. Well, This is something I haven't heard candidates talking about. That's usually first lady talk. You know, that, right. That the president does the real things of war and peace, while the guy who's going to be the president, while the first lady talks about the importance of libraries and things like that. I was very encouraged by that, and I think that there is a way of approaching people without saying you're ignorant, but saying we've got to do a lot better. We've got to know a lot more. This just isn't acceptable that we all know so little, and that grave decisions are being made on the basis of so little knowledge and curiosity.
Right down here.
First of all, I'm a product of that middle-brow culture. You know, I learned about opera on the Ed Sullivan Show. I learned about astronomy listening to Johnny Carson when I'd stay up late and my parents didn't know. And now chat shows are all about what movie have you got out and how low is your dress and how wealthy are you. So I think that's part of the problem. And my question is two parts. One political, that if it's not only from the top down, but that certainly would help, but all those of us who feel this lack of knowledge, when someone says something like, well, government is bad, should we take a greater role? And I try to do this, and maybe I talk too much, and say, well, we are the government, and it's not bad. They provide Social Security, so when you're retired, you get some money, and you know that is government, and Roosevelt showed that government could be helpful. So is it also that we have to reach out from the bottom up as well as from the top down? And the second part of my question is, how much is the corporatization of media? When you talk about college classes being ghettoized, it's the same thing where Ed Sullivan doesn't exist now, so someone who likes hip-hop never hears opera because they're only listening to hip-hop stations. And someone doesn't know about ballet because they've never seen it, because it's not only if you watch PBS. So how much does that also contribute to the problem?
I'm going to answer the segmentation of culture is a problem bigger than the media. I'm actually not going to address your first question because there are still so many people who have questions. The segmentation of the media both drives this cultural phenomenon and is a product of it. One of the things that's really bad about our culture today is everyone tends to listen only to those people they already agree with. And this is something that I say, while I don't believe in a golden age, there was a time when Americans were more willing to give a hearing to other points of view. My last book, Freethinkers, A History of American Secularism, I really welcomed the opportunity when I got lecture invitations. I thought, here is a great chance to educate people, especially I was invited to lecture at a lot of colleges, about a side of our history that's been neglected. And to some extent, I've been able to, but only to a small extent, because I found, as serious conservatives report on the lecture circuit as well, and by serious, I don't mean public nuisances like Ann Coulter, I mean serious conservatives, that people tend to go, just as they tend to watch on television, the columnists, the speakers that they already agree with. This was not true in the 19th century at all. Robert Ingersoll, who was known as the great agnostic and probably did as much to popularize Darwin's theory of evolution as anyone did, more people heard him than any orator in late 19th century in America. And the name that Orthodox religious people had for him was Robert Ingersoll. And one of the things that made them so angry was he had such huge audiences and made money from his lectures. And the fact is that Americans then really wanted to see whether the devil had horns. They wanted to hear what he had to say for themselves. There is very little of that in our culture. People don't want to give a hearing to opposing points of view. They don't even want to educate themselves about, if you will, what the opposition is saying. And the corporatization and segmentation of media both reflects and contributes to that trend.
In the back there, right behind you.
We've seen in the last 18 months or so a lot of books that have been on the bestseller list.
Can't hear you.
Oh, sorry. We've seen in the last 18 months or so a lot of books by people like Daniel Dennett and Richard Dawkins making it onto the bestsellers list. And I wonder if you think that this is representative of a shift, however slight, to a more rational way of thinking.
Do I think that seeing books like Daniel Dennett's books and Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens' God Is Not Great are a reflection of a shift, however slight, to a different kind of thinking? Well, first of all, I think that, you know, I think these people are doing a public service just by making atheism a subject for discussion. I think that's a valuable service. I don't think that they're representative of a real shift. I think they are reaching an audience that already existed and making discussion of these topics a lot more acceptable. However, you know, I should say as an atheist that atheists can be as anti-rational as anybody else. I don't find, for instance, Dawkins's arguments persuasive. I mean, I think they're contrary to the evidence that I see, as I interpret it, that moderate religion is just as bad as fundamentalist religion. I think if you look at moderate religion around the world, frankly, if the world were full of Unitarians and Reformed Jews and liberal Catholics, that I don't think that we would be having this discussion about the baleful influence of religion. And I think it's for a proselytizing atheist. I think that is not, to me, it's not an accurate look at the evidence. However, I also think that one thing that they're doing that is good is they're pointing out that atheism is not a belief system. It is not when I say to you I'm an atheist, I don't say I know there is no God. How could I know that? Any more than anybody knows who made God. But I, the evidence is persuasive to me that there probably isn't. But I can't tell you how the first piece of matter came into being or give an answer for that any more than when I was raised in Catholic school and the question is in the catechism was who made God? And the answer was God always was, always will be, and always remains the same. That's no answer.
I want to correct the biographical information about me that was given at the beginning. I am no longer a senior advisor to the president of the J. Paul Getty Trust. I am senior professor of English and religious studies at the University of California, Irvine. With regard to the rash of books that the last question referred to, I have two things to say. One is that the enormous explosion of talk about religion was triggered by 9/11. Before 9/11, there wasn't anything comparable to this, though there was evangelical Christianity in nearly the same strength that we see it now. So there is, in our culture, an enormous sense of rage and resentment at religious fanatics who have threatened us in this way. And Christopher Hitchens, in particular, has contributed to the directing of rage against Muslim citizens in our country by giving his book a Muslim-baiting title. I think that book in particular has not helped at all. It is important for us to make this a country that is as hospitable for Muslims as for non-Muslims.
Two more questions, right over here. Right there.
Science has brought us many good things, healthcare, amazing technology, and also it's giving us some insight into the future in terms of climate change. Could you specifically talk a little more about the anti-science bias in this country, and particularly when it's so important for perhaps bringing more good things in the future?
Well, I don't think people actually, apart from the anti-evolutionists who would say, I don't think that people would identify themselves as being anti-science. One of the historically in this country, this has been a country which has been very pro-technology, but very suspicious of what might be called pure science. America has always been above every country, and every country has this, interested in the practical benefits of science rather than in science itself. This is one of the reasons why people will say evolution is just a theory, because they don't understand the difference between a theory in science, which is based on a lot of evidence and can be modified by new evidence, and the kind of theory is, I might say, my theory is that all of you are wild-eyed radicals or something like that. They don't understand the difference between a theory, which is just somebody's opinion, and a theory in science. So I think a lot of the anti-science bias is not so much a bias as it's based on not understanding what it is. However, there is. The right-wing anti-science bias does come mainly from religious fundamentalism. But there is also a certain kind of left anti-science bias that is one of the rather unwanted children of the 60s and 70s, which is understandably distrust of scientists who place their services at the disposal of the military, which extended to being suspicious of all scientists. Distrust, for instance, in the feminist movement of the ways in which doctors used to routinely treat women, their little girl, patting her on the head, belief in alternative medicines unproved by any scientific studies at all, not subject to double-blind studies. So I think that there is also an anti-science bias from the left, a kind of disillusionment with, let's say, the abuses of expertise. And this is one of the things that has changed very much since I was growing up. Any of you who grew up in the 1950s know, and probably some of this was for worse as well as for better. There was great faith in science, in part because of the tremendous medical advances that all of us who grew up in the 50s witnessed. And these weren't medical advances like today's, designed to organ transplants, which, wonderful as they are, still benefit only a small proportion of people. They were advances which, for example, changed the fear of dying of polio, which every child of the 50s was raised with, to having polio eradicated. And the idea that there would be a strong anti-immunization movement, again, absolutely impervious to scientific studies demonstrating that that non-immunized children and immunized children incur autism at exactly the same rates, that there would be an anti-vaccination movement, a very active anti-immunization movement, would have been unthinkable in the 50s. And again, this is the media does contribute to this, and then I'll shut up about this. But every time I see a story about vaccinations and autism on the television, there is always on the one side, one heartbroken parent, and it's very understandable. Anybody to whom this tragedy has happened wants somebody to be responsible. And the truth is, we don't know what the causes of autism are, although it may be in genetic research we'll find it. But what happens is that the first symptoms of autism that an observant parent notices occur around the same time that children are receiving immunizations. So there will be a heartbroken parent on the one hand saying, my child got immunized against measles and 2 months later she was a vegetable. And then there will be a scientist or a doctor on the other hand saying that scientific studies show that the rates of autism between immunized and unimmunized children are exactly the same. And what the interviewer does is the heartbroken parent and the scientific evidence are placed on exactly the same level. And the media do this all the time about all sorts of scientific issues. You know, if you have somebody saying 2 plus 2 equals 5, and but some mathematicians say, of course, 2 plus 2 still equals 4.
During the 2004 presidential campaign, I spoke to Casey Cole, science reporter of the Los Angeles Times. At that time, there was a substantial effort on the part of American scientists, including David Baltimore at Caltech, to rally American public opinion at the way over the way that scientific opinion had been set aside and considered judgments offered to the administration had been overruled. She couldn't get the editors to publish the story. But I still take a certain amount of encouragement from that. You're not alone in this concern, and with a little daylight, I believe there's poised and ready to arise a kind of call for the reintroduction of science systematically into the conduct of American governmental affairs in particular. Back row.
One more, right?
This is the last question.
Hi, how are you doing? I dropped out of the University of Michigan in 83-84 in Flint, and hello, how are you? Please stay away from me, but you might hurt me on a football field or something. But how did
you... I can't hear you. It's hard to hear.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said I dropped out of the University of Michigan in 1983-84, and please stay away from me. You might hurt me on the football field. But it's just a joke. And how does your book affect grocery stores and the art world? That's the only question I have.
What?
I mean, we can rotate $1 an hour to 13 by government and perhaps control Great Depression, but thank you.
I have no idea what it is you were asking.
Something about grocery stores and the art world, but this Susan touches on many topics in her book. It's been a pleasure in enjoying your company, Susan.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.